The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So, good morning. I hope everybody had as wonderful a Shabbat as I did. We're going to have an interesting discussion. I think the topic of this discussion was, is your Bashiach really out there, or do you love the one you're with? Aside from getting to the particulars of that discussion, I hope that we'll be able to touch on a variety of different topics that have sort of come up during this weekend and we haven't really gotten to. And before we start, I actually want to dedicate this year, he's not here, but I want to dedicate this year to the memory of Eliyahu ben Aaron Zev HaLevi, who was the father of a dear friend who was nifter in the last couple of weeks. And he actually made it here. He wasn't sure if it was appropriate, and I'm very happy he came. And he should be a Melech Yashuv for us. He didn't come. Well, he did come, but we didn't see him. Listen to this email, because this says it to me, right? Sometimes we feel that we're having conversations, but we're just not having conversations. You know, talk about loving the one you're with. One of the challenges is, when you're with someone, are you really with them? And more appropriate, are they with you? Or are you in two totally different spaces? So listen to this, because I couldn't put this better, okay? Got this on an email. Friend recently sent me the following paper to describe the difference between men and women. Let's say, my friend wrote, a guy named Roger is interested in a woman named Elaine. He asks her out to dinner. She accepts, and they have a pretty good time. A few nights later, he asks her out again. And again, they enjoy themselves, and they continue to see each other regularly. And after a while, neither is seeing anybody else. I love this line. They don't actually decide to go out. They just happen to not be seeing anybody else. Okay, that's safe, right? Okay. And then one evening when they're driving home, a thought occurs to Elaine. And without really thinking, she says it aloud. Do you realize that as of tonight, we've been seeing each other for exactly 6 months? There is silence in the car. To Elaine, it seems like a very loud silence. She thinks to herself, I wonder if it bothers him that I said that. Maybe he's been feeling confined by our relationship. Maybe he thinks I'm trying to push him into some kind of obligation that he doesn't want or isn't sure of. Roger thinks, gosh, 6 months. And Elaine says to herself, but hey, I'm not so sure I want this kind of relationship either. Sometimes I wish I had a little more space, so I'd have time to think about whether I really want us to keep going the way we are moving steadily toward. I mean, where are we going? Are we just going to keep seeing each other at this level of intimacy? Are we heading towards marriage? Toward children? Toward a lifetime together? Am I ready for that level of commitment? Do I really even know this person? Roger appears to be in deep concentration. So he thinks, 6 months. That means it was, let's see, February when we started going out, which was right after I had the car at the dealer's. Which means, let me check the odometer. Whoa, way overdue for an oil change here. He appears inscrutable to Elaine, who nevertheless tries to divine his expression for clues. He's upset, she tells herself. I can see it on his face. Maybe I'm reading this completely wrong. Maybe he wants more from our relationship, more depth, more commitment. Maybe he has sensed, even before I sensed it, that I was feeling some reservations. Yes, she thinks, relieved to have figured it out. I bet that's it. That's why he's so reluctant to say anything about his own feelings. He's afraid of being rejected. Roger grips the steering wheel tightly. I'm going to have them look at this transmission again. I don't care what those morons say. It's still shifting to the right. They better not try to blame it on the cold weather this time. What cold weather? 87 degrees and this thing is shifting like a garbage truck. I paid those incompetent thieves $400. Elaine senses his anger. I don't blame him, she tells herself. I'd be angry too. I feel so guilty putting him through this, but I can't help the way I feel. I'm just not sure. Roger slowly, almost imperceptibly, shakes his head. They'll probably say it's only a 90-day warranty. Scumballs. Elaine thinks, maybe I'm just too idealistic, waiting for a knight to come riding up on his white horse, when I'm sitting right next to a genuinely good person. I am meeting a person I enjoy being with, a person I truly do care about, a person who seems to truly care about me, a person who's in pain because of my self-centered, schoolgirl, romantic fantasy. Roger is far away. Warranty? They want a warranty? I'll give them a warranty. I'll take their warranty and sue them. Roger, Elaine says aloud. What? Roger says, startled. Please don't torture yourself like this, she says, her eyes beginning to brim with tears. Maybe I should never have... Oh, I feel so... And she starts crying. What? Says Roger, genuinely perplexed. You have to understand, you ever have one of those moments, you know that you're missing something, you know it's important, you're just not sure what it is. I'm such a fool. Elaine sobs. I mean, I know there's no knight. I really know that. It's silly. There's no knight and there's no horse. There's no horse, says Roger. Starting to feel a bit uneasy with the direction of the conversation. You think I'm a fool, don't you? Elaine says. It's just that... No, says Roger, glad to finally know the correct answer. It's just that I need some time, Elaine says. There is a 15-second pause, while Roger, thinking as fast as he can, tries to come up with a safe response. Finally, he comes up with one that he thinks might work. Yes, he says. Elaine, deeply moved, sheds a tear and says, Oh, Roger, do you really feel that way? What way? Says Roger. That way about time, says Elaine. Oh, says Roger. Yes. Elaine turns to face him and gazes deeply into his eyes, causing him to become very nervous about what she might say next, especially if it involves horse. At last she speaks. Thank you, Roger, she says. Thank you, says Roger. Then he takes her home, and she lies on her bed, a conflicted, tortured soul, and weeps until dawn. When Roger gets back to his place, he opens up a bag of Doritos, turns on the TV, and immediately becomes deeply involved in a rerun of a tennis match between two Czechoslovakians he never heard of. A tiny voice in the far recesses of his mind tells him that something major happened in the car. But he is pretty sure that there's no way he would ever understand that. And so he figures it's better if he doesn't think about it at all. The next day, Elaine will call her closest friend, or perhaps two of them, and they will talk about this situation for 6 straight hours. In painstaking detail, they will analyze everything she said, everything he said, going over it time and time again, exploring every word, expression, and gesture for nuances of meaning. Considering every possible ramification, they will continue to discuss this subject off and on for weeks, maybe months, never reaching any definite conclusions, but never getting bored with it either. Meanwhile, Roger, while playing racquetball one day with a mutual friend of his and Elaine's, will pause just before serving, frown, and say, Norm, did Elaine ever own a horse? And that is the difference between men and women. Eh? So how do you figure that out? How do you get to be not just in the same car, but in the same car? At the end of the day, that's really much of what we want. And when I say we on this one, I include myself. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I'm married for 16 years, and I still sometimes walk away from the kitchen scratching my head. No idea what just happened, but convinced that I gave the right answers and escaped. Can't believe I'm taping this. How do we get to be on the same page? More than that, how do you know if you found the right person? I mean, you usually know when you found the wrong person. Sometimes people don't know that they found the wrong person. But when you found the wrong person, or the wrong person's found you, right? The difference between persistence and stalking, right? That's usually easy to figure out. And if you can't figure it out, which is reasonable, because sometimes you're in a relationship and it's hard, it's pretty easy for someone else from the outside to help you. But what about when you find a person, they're a good person, and that most dangerous of experiences, the anathema of Hollywood dating, you're comfortable. You just have a good time. He's a really nice guy. You know? What's the worst compliment you can get? Right? She's so sweet. Oof. Right? What do you do with that? Is that so terrible? How do you know if you found the right person? How do you know if maybe the other person isn't out there? How long do you go on with this journey? I mean, I'll give you an example, which to me is the paradigm for just about everything in life. Okay? Imagine that you meet a really nice girl. Anybody ever go to Paris? Go to Paris? So my brother and I, I was in the middle of the army, he was just finished. We were having this conversation with my parents. My dad was so thrilled that my brother finished the army, spent a lot of time in Lebanon. And he's like, in one of those magnanimous moments that teenage or college-age children dream of, says, you know what, I'm so happy you're finished the army. You tell me what I can do for you for a week. And I was like trying to beg my brother, say, just cut the phone off. We got to think about this one. Anyway, so we went to Europe for a couple weeks, right? And my dad basically said, listen, I'll give you a week with a car or a week in a hotel. You decide. Now, you're 22 years old. You just finished the army. You're in the middle of it. And you get a week with a car or a week with a hotel. What do you go for? Car. Yeah. You can live in a good car. So we got a Merc, okay? We got a Mercedes. There were only three cars during that whole week that actually passed us. Two of them were BMWs. No. And one of them was a Jaguar. Right? And we spent this week, you know. And then we got to Paris. We were a week in Switzerland. And we had thought that we would try to keep the car for a few more days. And basically got to this huge plaza where the Arc de Triomphe is. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been there, but there are like seven lanes. And it's a circle. And if you're in the middle lane, you can't get out. There's no way to get out. In fact, there's a little sign on the back of your car that says, idiot American. And the friends love this. They kind of pull back so you have a space. And then just as you're about to pull in, they speed up. They go, American, right? You know, it's impossible. So we went through this experience for about a half an hour, and we went straight to a rental car company and gave it back. What do you do in Paris besides museums and, you know, whatever? The Parisians have a very interesting pastime. They sit at cafes, and they women watch. It's really an amazing thing. In fact, I really get into watching the Parisian men watch women. And my brother and I had this game. We would sit at a cafe, like at the edge by the street, and I would sit with my back to the street. And I would watch all the men, and I'd be able to rate the women passing behind me by how they turn their heads. It was just an unbelievable thing. And they do it unabashedly. They have no problem with it, right? And there's different, like, levels of men passing. There's men going like this, there's men going like this, right? There's different levels, right? So you're sitting at a cafe, and you meet a nice girl, and she's wonderful, and you're having this whole discussion with her, and you feel like you're really connecting, and you're really bonding, and an hour turns into two, and you start to wonder, maybe this is the right person. But then you realize that across the street there's another cafe, and there's lots of people in that cafe. And what if the real reason you met this girl in this cafe is so that you could stay here long enough so that your beshert, the person you're supposed to spend the rest of your life with, would have time to get to that cafe. And then you start thinking, why did God put this thought into my head? Maybe because I'm supposed to go over to that cafe. Right? Otherwise I wouldn't think it. And after 3 hours of this, you just can't anymore. So you tell this girl, listen, I'll be right back. I just saw a friend, but wait right here. And off you go to the other cafe to see. And you know what? You see this incredible lady. And she's sitting at a table all by herself. And you walk over to her. You say, are you with anyone? And you say, no, the guy stood me up. Aha! So you sit with her for another 2 hours, now having forgotten about the first girl. And while you're sitting at the second cafe, you realize that now, directly in your vision, is a third cafe. And maybe the only reason that this girl was stood up was so that you could stay in this cafe long enough for someone to go to that cafe. And so on and so on and so on. And it just seems like life is full of lots of cafes. How do you do that? How do you make the decision to stay in this cafe? How many people would be married, happily married? And by the way, don't think this only applies to love and relationships. It applies to everything. It applies to learning. It applies to business ventures. It applies to grabbing moments when you could be grabbing other moments. Everything in life. How do you make that decision? Which maybe leads us to the third piece, which is there such a thing as a Bashert? I mean, does this exist? Is there one person out there who's meant to be the one for you? If I'm married, does that mean that I found the one for me? Now realize, if there is one person for me, does that mean that if you marry someone and it doesn't work out, you get a divorce, that you didn't marry your Bashert? Must be, because you didn't end up with him. But if that's true, then how do you know when you're marrying someone that they're your Bashert? I mean, what if you're up under the chuppah and you're looking down at the audience and you're seeing another cafe? I once had a discussion with someone who was afraid to get married because he didn't feel that he'd arrived at the place where he could know, standing up under the chuppah, that he wouldn't still be thinking maybe somebody else could come along. How do you go there? What do you do with that? So I want to share with you a couple of ideas that I think are worth thinking about. I can't tell you that this is the be-all, end-all. I get very nervous when people claim to have a copyright for the truth. All I can do is share with you a perspective that's been meaningful for me. I think this is based on Divrei Chazal and what Judaism teaches. But what you do with it is up to you, but at the very least, it's a valuable thought process. So in no particular order, because that seems to be appropriate for a Sunday morning, first of all, the concept of a Bashert. I'll tell you a very interesting idea. And if you get nothing else but this piece, this changed the way I looked at this whole recipe. Okay? Imagine for the moment, this is really the Rambam, or at least how I understand the Rambam, in the Moreh Nevuchim, Maimonides, in the Guide to the Perplexed, in Chelek Gimel. And the Rambam says something very interesting, and he's not only referring to Shidduchim, to marriages, but in general in life, but I'm going to translate this to this issue. Imagine for the moment that somewhere out there is actually a perfect 10. There's a woman, or man, who is the yin to your yang. I mean, you know, when I got married, I had this brown suit. I liked this brown suit. I thought it was cool. I thought it made me look good, you know. Liked the way it swayed. I had this brown suit for, must have been like, what, 6-7 years, right? And we started going out. And one day my wife says, you know, why do you wear that suit? That's how you know you're serious already, when they feel comfortable enough to say that, right? Why do you wear that suit? Now, why do you wear that suit does not mean, oh, honey, I'm just curious what the story is behind that suit, right? Why do you wear that suit really means, is there a trash can nearby, right? And I said, I hadn't really considered it. You know, I like the suit, whatever. And we had a couple discussions about the suit, but they weren't serious. And then when I got married, my wife's a wise woman, we didn't have a suit discussion. That suit just magically disappeared. Just disappeared. Didn't notice it, you know. Went shopping. My wife got me a couple of new suits. Now, of course, if you get a new suit and you're just married, that's what you're going to wear. So you're not noticing where the old suit is. And my wife basically told me one day, said, by the way, that old suit, got rid of that. Burned it. It's dead. You know, there's a beggar on the east side living with it now. Right? And that's okay, because, you know, happy marriage, brown suit. You know, I'm okay with that. But there is out there maybe somewhere a perfect 10. Maybe this would be the woman who actually loved me in my brown suit. I don't know. Somebody who taps into who you are. Somebody who shares your visions and your dreams and your goals. Who loves what you love. Who doesn't like what you don't like. Who is so interesting to you. Who compliments you in ways that allow you to grow. Everything. Perfection. Perfect 10. And maybe in order to meet this perfect 10, maybe you have to be in a very high level to merit meeting such a perfect 10. Or, by the way, and we're not going to go there right now, maybe you have to be on such a low level that you're going to use up all your reward in this world on meeting this perfect 10. It doesn't really matter for the moment. But what if you're not Mr. Perfection and you still got some work to do, so maybe you don't merit to meet a perfect 10. But you meet a perfect 9. You meet a 9. Now, if you meet a 9, so she may not like your suit, but you share the same dreams, and you share the same goals, and you trust her, and you respect her, and she's willing to work at it just like you're willing to work at it, and that's great. Now, I'll tell you an interesting thing. If you meet a person who's a 9, and you sense that they're a 9, marry them. Because if you work at it, you'll turn your marriage into a 10. And I'll tell you something else that's interesting. If you meet someone who's a 10, and you don't work at it, won't be long before that marriage is a 9. Now, what about if you meet an 8? Well, I personally think that you can make a great marriage out of an 8. It just takes more work than a 9. And it sounds ridiculous to be putting mathematical equations to love and relationships, but we do this all the time. So just for the purpose of the discussion, you could meet a person who's an 8, and you could put in the work, and she could put in the work, and you could turn that 8 into a 9, and you could eventually turn it into a 10. And if you don't work at a 10, you could turn it into an 8. Now, what happens if you meet someone who's a 2? If you meet someone who's a 2, you need to have good friends around you. Okay? Because the amount of work that it would take to turn a 2 into a 10, or even into a 9, might rip you apart. But understand that it is doable. But it would rip you apart. Right? There's a story told about the Chazon Ish. And, you know, I debate in mentioning the story, mentioning that it's the Chazon Ish, but he once quoted it of himself, so that's what allows me to do this. Supposedly the Chazon Ish, his wife, was not a simple cup of tea. Let's put it that way. Okay? I think they'd refer to this in today's jargon as a piece of work. Right? And she was not a simple person. And it was not easy for him. And one of his talmidim once asked him, you know, Rebbe, why are you zocheh to this in your life? And his response was, right, I guess Hashem feels that I'm on the level that I can make this work. And that's a powerful line. If you're a Chazon Ish, you can turn a 2 into a 10. And I don't know the Chazon Ish. I don't know his wife. I don't know their marriage. So for me, it's just an allegory. But maybe some people are on that level. Most of us aren't. Now here's the interesting question. The day you get married, how do you know, maybe the day you get engaged, if you found an 8, a 9, or a 10? How do you know? You know what the answer is? What does it matter? What's the difference? If you marry someone, you have to put in a tremendous amount of work. You have to learn to listen. You have to learn to care. You have to learn to share. You have to tap into what a whole different person feels. You have to learn to open up your boundaries and create new ones. So much work at making a marriage work. It's a different kind of work than finding the right person. It's a work that's much more enjoyable, but it is work. Now, if you met an 8 and you're willing to work at it, it'll be a 10. And if you met a 10 and you're willing to work at it, it'll stay a 10. So what's the difference whether she's an 8 or a 10? And this, I think, is our problem. I don't think you have to find the Besheret, not because the Besheret isn't out there. Maybe you're zocheh to find the Besheret, and maybe you're not. It's not your issue. Your issue is to find the range. Now, it could be that if I was living in Radin 100 years ago, I wouldn't be having this discussion. But, you know, like the Rebbe was saying yesterday, we have to live with reality. We are who we are. And the idea that I can only find one person has set so many people into cafe hunting. But if you're looking for a range, it doesn't matter if there's a 10 at that cafe. All that matters is that right now, in this cafe, there's someone that I can work with. And by the way, this brings me to another topic. And anybody who's ever met me, this is just a pet topic that I think is really important. So we probably ended up talking about it, so I apologize if we repeat it. But I happen to think Chazara, review, is good for the soul. I met a fellow once. I hadn't seen him in a while. And we were in the lobby of a building in Manhattan, one of the Jewish dormitories, you know, the Columbia, the West Bank, whatever, right? Key West, right? And there's a better place, Key West, than that, Key West, but for another time. Anyway, I'm waiting for somebody to build a skyscraper with lots of Jewish students and call it, like, Jerusalem. You know, but anyway, it's like one of these buildings where people walk around in their pajamas down the hall, you know? And I'm sitting in the lobby waiting for somebody. I run into this guy, and I haven't seen him in a while, and he's a student, just a really fine person. And so we're having this discussion. I said, so, you know, have you met anybody? He said, it's funny you ask. He said, I'm actually going on a second date tonight, and I'm going on a third date on Thursday. So I thought to myself, well, that's a strange sentence. Obviously, if you're going a second date tonight, you're going on a third date on Thursday. So I told him, well, duh, you know. He said, no, two different girls. Get it? So I said, no, I really don't get it. What do you mean? She says, well, I know, you meet a girl, and she's interesting, you go on a date, but then someone sets you up with another girl, so you go on that date, and you're really not sure either one of them is right, so you keep dating both of them. Now, this may not be news to you, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. So I said to him, you know, if you're dating two girls in the same week, you're not really dating either of them, right? You're in two cafes running across the street. You're having a conversation with one person on the cell phone, and another person on the landline. So you're not talking to either one. Now, some people think they can handle that. So he said, no, it's not true. So I said, well, do you have a limit? Like, how long does this go? What if you don't know? Like, how many dates? He says, I usually do it for 3 to 7 dates, which means there's no limit. 3 to 7 dates. Now, I don't know about you. When I was first going out with Dorit, you know, so we saw each other every day, all the time, for a weekend. But sometimes people meet. You meet a guy, he's from Boston, you're in New York. That's possible. So one date is this week, and the next date is next month. So for 6 months, you're dating two people at the same time. What do you do on, what if they have the same birthday? Do you buy both of them a birthday present? So I said to him, well, and he said, what's wrong with that? He said, you know, if you were out on a date with one of these girls and the other one walked into the cafe, like, would that be a problem? You know what his answer was to me? I promise you. He says, oh, that would never happen. I said to him, you know, it will happen because I'm going to find out who these two girls are. And I want you to know that this is a challenge. You know, the pasuk says kedushim to you. Right? Kedushim to you, Hashem Elokechem. It's interesting that this pasuk, Parashat Kedushim, which contains all the essential ideas of ethics that the Jewish people have, right? It's almost the exact center point of the Torah, as if to say this is the meat, this is the center of everything. Okay, all right. So Rashi says, what does it mean kedushim to you? The Ramban says, Al tiya naval b'rishut haTorah. Be an ethical person, don't be a pig, whatever it might be, right? Okay. Rashi, on the other hand, says, Hevu prushin min arayot. What does it mean to be kadosh, to be holy? Distance yourself from licentious behavior, from sexual relations that are improper. That's a very strange thing. That's the definition of kedusha. I mean, I'm not saying it's not important, but that's the definition of sanctity, that you shouldn't sleep with your sister. We are a holy nation. We don't sleep with our sisters. I mean, I'm not saying it's an important mitzvah, but like that's not the... And this is Rashi. So you could say the reason that Rashi says that is because in Vayikra Perek Yutet, this follows the whole list of the arayot, of all of these types of, you know, don't sleep with your sister and your mother-in-law and the dog next door and whatever it might be, right? Literally, right? So, but that doesn't help me with the question because Kadosh Baruch Hu put those two things next to each other for a reason. So I learned the answer to this question from a student. I was once giving a class at Israelite. And, you know, we get students at Israelite from all over the world. And from every background you can imagine. And it's challenging, you know, you have deep content. And you're talking to, you know, one person who learned in the mirror. And then maybe a reform rabbi sitting at the table. And then maybe a guy who's, you know, giving shiur even in NYU. And a student who doesn't know the difference between an aleph and beis. And all everywhere in between. And there's something powerful about that. And we're all sitting on the table. And somehow we got into the discussion of, you know, premarital relations, right? And, you know, one of the students is asking questions after the class, Q&A. So I'm talking about why, you know, you don't have premarital sex and why in Judaism that's powerful and what it means for a relationship, etc. So one girl there, you know, we've been together already in this program for about, 9-10 days. She says, wait a second. She says, I hope you don't mind my asking, I don't understand this. You're telling me before you got married, you only had relations with one person? I said, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. Before I got married, I didn't have relations with anyone. So now she's really shocked. So, you know, the class ends. She comes over to me afterwards. She says, I need to understand this. Did you tell me before you got married, you never had a physical relationship with a girl? I said, no. She says, I don't understand that. She says, you know, look, I don't slip around. I'm not a loose, you know, I'm a good person. But, you know, just in the last month, I've met 4 different guys, you know, and I spent a week with each of them. And, you know, one of them I'm still seeing, but the other one I met. Sound familiar, right? So, you know, I met Bill and Ted and whoever else, and I slept with Bill, and I slept with them. Right? Bill and Ted's excellent adventure, right? I mean, it's, you know. And that makes sense to me, she says, because how could I know if I'm compatible with Bill, right? If I've met Ted, and I want to know it. I want to explore this stuff when I'm married. So I said to her, you know, what's interesting is, if you're with Bill and Ted, you're not really with either of them. And that's really what kedushim to you means. You know, getting married and getting a relationship is challenging to us because, by definition, it limits us. You have to limit yourself in order to develop a relationship, right? You know you're in a relationship when you limit yourself to one person, right? You wouldn't get married and then go out for dinner with some other lady, right? Because you're married. Well, what does that really mean? It means that my life and my attention now is for you and only for you. By the way, we do the same thing on Kadosh Baruch Hu. Right? Get to a point where we want to have a relationship with Hashem, We have to limit ourselves and let go of all the other idols, all the things that get in the way. However, what's interesting is, when I choose to limit myself, now listen to this line, when I choose to limit myself to one person, then and only then can I discover unlimitedness with that person. To discover unlimitedness, I have to be willing to limit myself. Do you hear that? Develop a relationship with someone, you have to let them into your space. Right? That's the definition of a hug, right? You let somebody in. But you don't let everybody into your space. You limit yourself, and you discover unlimitedness. And that's very deep. So I said to this guy, you know, I really think you should think about dating one person at a time. If you're with a girl, and you've met her, and you think she's interesting, pursue that relationship. And pursue it only with her. And pursue it at a healthy, gradual pace. And if you feel that you need someone else, then that means that this girl isn't for you, and you need to let it go. It's not right. It's not fair. And interesting, by the way, postscript, is that this guy is now married. And he attributes this marriage to the fact that he stopped double dating. I don't know, and I don't want to know, because whatever, but if anybody's curious about this topic, you're welcome to come to me afterwards. But if you do this, if you date more than one person at a time, and I understand it's a pressure, ask yourself to look backwards. However old you are now, 25, 30, 35, 40, if you do this, and you're dating two guys at the same time, or two girls at the same time, because you're convinced that if you don't date this second one, you might miss them, ask yourself to look back. If you've been doing this for 10 years, it obviously doesn't work. Dating twice as many people does not guarantee that you're going to meet the right person. I would venture to say it almost guarantees you're not going to meet the right person. Because we can sense this. So the first thing is that I'm not looking for the person. I'm looking for a person who I can build the relationship with. And the second thing is that if I want to discover that relationship and I want to build that relationship, I have to be willing to work at it. I have to be willing to focus on it. I have to let go of everything else. By the way, that's why this type of experience is so difficult. Because when you walk into a dining room and there's 400 people, so it's very hard to pick one person, sit with them, and spend a weekend with them. And some of you will look back, and I say this to you now because it's Sunday morning and you have another day. Don't be determined to meet 40 people in the next day. Just meet one. Not because that one is the one you're going to date. Let go of that. You've been here a Shabbos already. You haven't met your beshert by now, whatever it means. Let's assume you're not going to. Or let's assume at least that you can't know and that you won't figure it out by this afternoon. So don't figure that I'm looking for the guy who I can make the relationship with that I'm going to marry. Figure that there's a person here that I can get to know so well that he will introduce me to people or I can introduce him to someone. Get to know one person. Because if you have one more person out there who really gets to know you, if you get to know one person and they value you as a friend and you're on their mind and they're on your mind, then you've just created a whole other Soyu at Sinai web engine out in the field on a practical level. On a deeper level, which is really what this is about, you've taken another step towards what Judaism wants us to do. Right? You've met another human being. You've made a connection. You've shared a little goodwill and a little chesed and a little love and a little loving kindness. You've made the world a better place. When you do good and the world becomes a better place, then good things come your way. And even if good things don't come your way, it's just good to do good. And this brings us to the third piece. So what about knowing if who I'm with is the one I should be with? You know, I guess there are two pieces here, and I'll share them with you and then take a few questions because I want to push the envelope. First, what happens if you're with someone and you really like them and you can't say anything bad about them and you think they're a really good person, but you're not nuts about them? You don't go to sleep at night just not being able to get off the phone. Okay? You're not at that point where you can't get enough of them. So I would tell you two things. First of all, I want you to be aware that there's a reason that this happens less and less as we grow older. Okay? This kind of romantic, I can't live without her, and I can't get off the phone, and I'm doodling her name in class, right? Okay? I was used to know when one of my yeshivas was going out with a girl, and I could usually tell her name because it was all over the, you know, the side of the notebook, right? There's a Gemara. The Gemara says, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah in Perek Revi, but it applies to many mitzvot. That the beginning of the parak, it talks about the fact that Rosh Hashanah shechal b'yot b'Shabbat, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbat, Shabbat Mikdash ayu tokin v'lo b'mdina. Right? They used to blow shofar in the Beit Mikdash. There's a whole discussion why you blow shofar in the Beit Mikdash and why you don't blow shofar out of the Beit Mikdash. And the idea is that rabbinic decrees, right, sort of things that we have to be aware of, we don't need to worry about in the Beit Mikdash because we're in the presence of Hashem. But the Zohar asks an interesting question. Let's understand why we have all these mitzvot that we don't do on Shabbat. Lulav, Megillah, Shofar. She says, well, because he's a good Jew, I'll answer your question with another question. Mm-hmm. Do you ever notice on Yom Tov, when you daven, so in the Siddur, it adds a word, right? It says Be'ahava. Do you ever notice that? Right? If Yom Tov falls on Shabbat, we add the word Be'ahava at the end of the bracha, right? Why do we do that? Hashem doesn't love us on Yom Tov unless it's Shabbat. So the Zohar says a very interesting thing. This is so deep. He says, you know, the relationship that we have with God on Yom Tov is like erusin. It's like engagement. The relationship we have with God on Shabbat is like marriage. Now, what's the difference between erusin and nisuin, engagement and marriage? So engagement is a very emotional experience. Unbelievably exciting. I mean, you can't wait to see her, and you're thinking about her, and you're bringing her presents, and, you know, you're talking about all sorts of issues, and you come home with chocolates and with flowers and all this sorts of stuff. And, you know, it's the end of the day, and you're working, and especially if you're young, and you look at your watch, you know, and it's 5 o'clock, and I can't wait 2 more minutes, and I'm going to be able to go see her. And then you get married. I don't know many husbands who can't wait till the end of their business day, they're married 20 years, to see their wife. Right? And, you know, to be honest, if I came home every day with chocolates and flowers and candies and whatever, my wife threw me out of the house. Who has time for those things? We don't have money for those things. But when you're married, you give to your wife a much deeper gift. You give to your wife yourself. Yishtoke gufo, you become one. But you live asar echad. So that's much deeper. So on one level, there's an emotional experience which naturally changes when we get married because we give something much deeper. And on a certain level, the older you get, the more you get a taste of this, and the more it becomes difficult to do the first. But I'll go into something else. The older you get, the more stuff you have in your head. The more restaurants you're at. If you're 30 years old, and you're working in a business, and you're finishing some online degree, and you're on Saw You at Sunday, so you're checking your profiles, right? And there's so many different things, so it's very hard to focus. And because you're very hard to focus, and because you have so many different things that are on your mind, maybe it's hard to cop that feeling. I would even go a stage further. I think that that illusion, that romantic experience, that intense energy, which happens very often to couples when they meet when they're young, that's a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because you're too dumb to get married. We talked about this yesterday. You don't know enough. And if you knew, if I knew when I was 25, what I know now, I don't know if I would have gotten married so fast. When I met my wife on a Thursday night, we had met once for about 10 minutes, 5 years earlier, 4 years earlier. I thought she was really cute. I found out that she was going back to America. She'd been a year in Bar Ilan. And I was like, you know what, I just did this. I went out with a girl, she went back to America. It was not something you aspire to do. You know, these 6,000-mile relationships don't work. And so I decided I wasn't going through this again. 4 years later, 5 years later, she showed up in Israel. And there was a party, and, you know, somebody said she was coming. I figured, you know, I'll go to the party, it's down the street. Right? That was on a Thursday night. By Sunday, Monday, I mean, you know, we'd spent like, I don't know, 100 hours with each other. And the challenge was, well, what do you do with this? Because we've only been going out for 4 days. And I remember we're sitting there on Tuesday night. I'll never forget this. We're sitting there on Tuesday night. This is how I knew that she was the right person. Sitting with her on Tuesday night, and she looks at me and says, I want you to know that I know we're going to get married. Right? And then she says, and I want you to know that you know we're going to get married. She says, when you know that you know, let me know. And I didn't run. So I said, no. And I didn't know anything. I did not know anything. I had no idea what I was really looking for. I wasn't even looking to get married. I was just so nuts about her. I figured, like, why not? So we got married. And then, you know, you wake up gradually. You realize it's not so simple. It's a lot of work. But all the things that I never thought about, I'm married now, so we'll work them out. And I think that what Rabbi Dizumai said yesterday, you know, Shmonasei L'Chuppah is exactly true. So we don't live in the world where everybody's ready for Shmonasei L'Chuppah. Most of us are not, 18, most of us are not ready to have that discussion with our parents, and I understand that. But that's part of the challenge. And that romantic excitement wears off. That's also a gift to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because when it wears off, then you can really start to work. And it does wear off. Guaranteed. In different ways. And don't get me wrong, I'm very much in love with my wife. We walk around holding hands and everything else. And I'm nuts about her. But it's a very different thing than what happened when I was 25. Because now it's the result of what we've done. And this brings me to my last point. So what do? If you're with someone, and they're really nice, and you like them, but you really want to be more in love with them. Do you ever wonder, what happens if I get married, and a year later I realize I'm not in love? Do you ever worry about that? Do you ever wonder about that? Some people worry about that. So I had a friend who struggled with this, you know? You wake up 15 years later, 20 years later, you're married, you have kids, and all of a sudden you're not in love with your wife. So this fellow came to talk to me, we were talking about this. So I told him, what's the problem? You're not in love with your wife? Good, love your wife. So he looks at me like I'm some kind of an idiot. So you don't understand, love is not a noun. Love is a verb. That's not just a line, that is so true. People think you're looking for love, right? One of the titles, looking for love. You don't look for love, you don't find love, you build love. Love is something you do. Somewhere along this weekend somebody mentioned this, and in my opinion this is a topic that has to come up every time you have these discussions. You know, the word love comes from the word hav, ava, hav lilintu. We mentioned this yesterday. So love is all about giving, as opposed to, let's say, lust, which is all about taking, right? When you love someone, they're a partner. When you lust someone, they're an object. That's why love grows, because you're working at it, and lust wanes. Because lust is all about me, and love is all about you. And the part of love that's also about me is still for you, and for everyone else. So if you don't love someone, and you want to love someone, love them. And if love is all about giving, give to them. Now think about the things in your life that you really love. The things in your life that you really love are the things you give the most to. That's why we love our children so much, because we give them everything. And that's why they have a hard time loving us at a certain point, because they don't have that much to give us. When a kid is 4 years old, he has no problem loving us, because he senses that just his existence gives to us. But then the kid becomes 14. What does he have to give his parents? They have everything. So it's very hard for him to love us. It takes a while for him to come around and realize how much he has to give for us. And a kid who wants to love his parents finds ways to give to them. That's why Judaism is so focused on chesed. Right? I do chesed for my parents every week. Not because they need it, because it helps me build my relationship with them. And they do chesed for me, sometimes through my children. Do an experiment. Pick someone that you're not interested in marrying. Just to be a friend with. And give tremendously to them and watch how, after a while, you will feel in love with this person. Maybe not a romantic love. Now imagine you're in a relationship. If you want this relationship to work, give to it. Give to it your focus. Give to it your ear. You know, one of the most difficult things, one of the things that men can learn from women, generally speaking, is to learn how to listen. Women know how to listen. Men love to talk. I'm not saying always. There are, Baruch Hashem, enough women to talk. But we do. Go on a date. You know what a healthy date is? A healthy date is in the first 2-3 minutes of the date, it's very quiet. Because both of you want to listen to each other. That's a very healthy date. Don't think if it's so quiet at the beginning, this is a bad sign. Then sometimes you go on a date and the guy can't handle silence. So he starts filling it up with all this talk. And 3 hours later you realize the whole evening you heard him talk. By the way, this is another mistake we make. So you walk away from a date like that and say, I can't go out with this guy, all he wants to do is hear himself talk. Here's a radical thought. Why not tell him? Why not say to him, listen, you know, I'll be honest with you. I think you're a really special guy. We spent the whole evening together. We didn't really talk. You talked about you. So you do it in a nice way. You think you're doing the guy a favor if you don't tell him that? He'll just do it another 50 dates. Then he'll spend millions on therapy, and one day someone will tell him, you know, you talk too much. You could do him a favor. You could tell his friend. So if I'm in a relationship, and he's a really nice person, and I want to see if I can really love this person, give to that relationship. And I think these things, as a common thread, have the potential to turn our relationships into meaningful relationships. And I cannot stress enough. There were definitely certain things said yesterday that I'm not sure I'm on the same page with, but I do believe that you reach a point in a relationship where you have to swim or you have to walk away. You know, if you're in a relationship for a certain amount of time, and you know what that time is, you don't need anybody else to tell you. If you're seeing a guy for 2 years, and you don't know if you want to marry him, he doesn't know if he wants to marry you, it's time to move on. You know? So that's as a general overview.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.